driven by Briggs Auto Lane.
Let's have some fun. Let's go.
And BriggsAuto.com. Get in the game.
Welcome to Hour 2 of the game. Tyler Dreiling and Grant Flanders with you until 6 o'clock. Manhattan High basketball will take over at that point. Both the boys and the girls in action tonight at the MHS Gymnasium. And a couple of very big games for both of them against the Shawnee Heights Thunderbirds. MHS looking to stay atop the Centennial League standings, both the boys and the girls, but they will need victories to do that against a couple of very solid teams in Shawnee Heights. John Kurtz and Mitch Fortner will have the call for those. The girls around 6 o'clock, the boys to follow, so we'll be taking you up to that point. In this hour, we'll talk to Cole Manbeck here in just a couple of moments about K-State and KU. Last night, the Jayhawks getting the better of the Wildcats by the slimmest of margins for a second time this season. We will go more in-depth about K-State's struggles at one particular position over the course of Big 12 play and the significance of that. Also, an update on how things look for K-State in the NCAA tournament outlook. And we will finish it off with You Can't Be Serious. We had a couple of phone calls in the first hour. We may have some time this hour as well. 537-1350-866-776-1350 if you want to give us a call. But we start by being joined by Cole Manbeck, who was in studio with us for Powercat Game Day yesterday and then at Bramlage Coliseum for last night's game. Cole, let me start with this. I mean, it's kind of what we talked about with John in the first hour, but it doesn't seem like there was anything too shocking about what transpired last night. K-State playing very hard, playing very competitive with its rival, but not being able to make the plays they needed to make down the stretch. Was there anything that really surprised you about how last night's game developed?
Well, I think the start of the game, you know, I expected K-State to come out fired up and energized, but I expected KU to do the same. So really, the only thing that caught me off guard is how K-State hit KU so early with that 20-8 lead. And, you know, you knew KU would, you know, make a run and get back into the game. But I think, you know, that's one of the areas where K-State lost that game, is they had some opportunities to keep that lead. You know, KU's going to make some pushes at you, but K-State just stopped scoring for a segment of that game in the first half and lost an opportunity to go into the halftime with the lead. You know, and I think that stung. I think KU going into halftime up 2 instead of K-State maybe going up 6 or 7 into the locker room was a little bit of a deflating blow, even though K-State eventually came back and took a 1-point lead late in the second half.
We mentioned this a little bit in the first hour as well, and I talked about how, well, since we're here in Manhattan talking about things from a K-State perspective, maybe it doesn't, or maybe it gets overlooked a little bit, but I know that you're really good at looking at what happens on both ends of the floor. And how much better do you think KU was on the defensive end in this game versus the first time these teams played?
Well, one of the things that was interesting that KU did defensively was they really extended their pressure on K-State. So they were really pushing K-State out beyond the arc, especially early in the game. And I thought that made K-State's guards uncomfortable. That's part of why K-State turned it over, you know, its first 3 possessions of the game without even getting a shot up. And so KU really extended their pressure out, trying to make K-State's guards uncomfortable and taking away the entry pass into the post. You know, so there were opportunities there to do some back cuts against KU. I don't think K-State did a very good job of that, of adjusting on the offensive end of the floor and, you know, hitting them because they were so aggressive on the ball up the line, playing K-State's guards out there that, you know, there was an opportunity to hit some backdoor cuts on them. And then I certainly think it was just interesting how K-State attacked them offensively, because there were, I thought there were too many times where DJ Johnson was catching the ball out on the perimeter. He was the guy setting the ball screen up top at the top of the key, which, you know, I think you want Dean Wade doing that because he's the pick and pop guy. And when DJ Johnson goes out there and sets the screen or catches the ball, it enables Landon Lucas, who was guarding DJ Johnson the majority of the game, to just kind of play a zone in the paint and not come out and guard him. So that takes away Wade's effectiveness because he's basically being double teamed with help defense with LeGerald Vick. So that would have been one adjustment I would have made. But, you know, KU did adjust. They played more aggressive on the defense end, and I thought made K-State uncomfortable.
There wasn't anything that happened in the final 3 or 4 minutes of that one that we haven't seen before in some capacity, but something that does absolutely catch your eye. KU's last field goal in this game came with 2 minutes and 34 seconds left. K-State's technically came with less than a second left on Wesley Iwundu's tip-in, but before that, it was with about 2 minutes and 45 seconds left. So neither team was great on the offensive end down the stretch. But what was most disappointing to you about the way K-State finished this game?
Well, I think they settled too much. You know, I thought they were impatient on the offensive end and, you know, settled and shot some jump shots, shot some threes that, you know, they really didn't need to do. Because I thought K-State was really starting to adjust and attack inside with DJ Johnson and Dean Wade. Look, KU couldn't stop Dean Wade and DJ Johnson. I know I just talked about how K-State struggled to get into the post, but when they did, KU struggled to stop them. This is the part, not just the end of the game, but what I thought was most disappointing is you look at the final numbers and you see Kamau Stokes and Barry Brown are 8 of 30 combined from the floor. And then you see DJ Johnson and Dean Wade combined to go 12 of 19, scoring 34 points, while Stokes and Brown combined for 22 on 11 more shots. So why does DJ Johnson only have 7 shot attempts? Why does Dean Wade only have 12? Those are the guys that were scoring and actually hitting their shots, you know, at a consistent rate. So I thought K-State settled for too many jump shots overall in the game, and I certainly thought that was disappointing. And then, you know, the way K-State finished, I think the frustrating thing when you look at it, and this is what makes KU good, when K-State got the lead, KU immediately went down. Frank Mason draws a foul. They go back up one. They take the momentum right away from you. Dean Wade hits the baseline three to tie it at 63. Crowd's excited. And then K-State makes a huge mistake, and they have three guys go to guard Josh Jackson, who's in a poor position. He's not going to be able to do anything where he was at on the baseline. He was trapped. But K-State had three guys come down, guard him, left the shooter, Mikhailu, the one guy you can't leave open on the floor. He buries the three. And so, you know, just little mistakes like that, helping off shooters, that's something that was disappointing.
Something that I think is pretty concerning for this team going forward, at least affecting their chances to make the NCAA tournament. They really need to get more out of Barry Brown and Xavier Sneed. Those two guys were fairly invisible on the floor last night, and Sneed's two free throws that he made early in the second half were the only two bench points that K-State scored in this ballgame. But out of those two guys, which one do you think is more important that K-State finds a way to get them in a rhythm as we start to enter this stretch run of the season?
Well, you know, Sneed's a freshman, and I think sometimes he reminds me of Rodney Magruder as a freshman. And when he hits shots early in the game, his confidence rises. And when he doesn't, you know, things go south. I remember sitting behind the K-State bench in the NCAA tournament, Rodney Magruder's freshman year, and he missed a shot early in the game, and Frank Martin turned around to the bench and said, Rodney's done for the game. You know, he kind of knew his confidence at that point in his career. It'd become a mental thing, and I think Xavier Sneed's mentally tough, but I think maybe his confidence, last couple games he struggled, and, you know, you saw when he missed a couple free throws, his shot just wasn't there. And so, for me, it's Sneed, just because he's that sixth man off the bench, so he brings that energy to the floor to give you a spark, and when he doesn't do that, you really don't have anyone else coming off the bench that can give you a spark. I mean, Corby Irvin scored 2 points total in the last four games, so that's not going to get it done. I know he's not necessarily a scorer, but you got to get more production there. So that's why I say Sneed, because otherwise you really don't have anything coming off the bench to help you.
Cole Manbeck, our Powercat Game Day blogger, with us for a couple more minutes. Cole, K-State is now 2 out of 3 games. I guess 2 games done out of 3 with this daunting stretch against top 15 competition, with a win at Baylor, a loss versus Kansas, and then they have West Virginia coming up this weekend. But what have we learned about this team from the first 2 games of this stretch, and where do you think they're at with postseason hopes right now?
Well, you know, I don't know what I've necessarily learned other than what we already kind of know, is that they can compete with the best teams, but they struggle to close out games. And, you know, they're just an inconsistent ball club, and that's the issue that they've had, you know, the last 2 or 3 seasons, really. It's just putting a string of good games together. Now, I'm not going to say K-State played awful yesterday, because if you play awful, you don't lose to KU by only 3 points. But, you know, there was certainly an opportunity there to knock off KU, and it's kind of a lost chance there that really could have made your season and taken it north. And now, you know, K-State's put itself in a position where, you know, they're going to be in a lot of must-win games down the stretch. You've got 6 losses in the league right now. You know, I struggle to see them winning at West Virginia, because, you know, they already beat West Virginia. It's a revenge game. West Virginia's already lost twice at home in Big 12 play. I don't expect them to have a letdown again. against K-State. I mean, it could happen, but I would be shocked if K-State goes to Morgantown and wins that game. So you're talking about a team that's 5-7, really needing to go 4-2 down the stretch to get into the NCAA tournament, in my opinion. And the fact that this is a team that's only won consecutive games two different times over their last 45 Big 12 games, it's hard for me to go out on a limb, no matter the competition, and predict this team to go 4-2. And so, you know, that Iowa State game after Saturday, if they don't win at West Virginia, that's going to be a must-win. All their home games from here on out are must-wins, and then you got to win one on the road at least.
I'm going to play devil's advocate with you for just a minute before I let you go, but I did feel reasonably good about K-State's chances going into the Baylor game, given what the situation was. I didn't feel great about last night. And there's still a lot of time that has to pass before we get to that West Virginia game. But I will say this in terms of how much energy those two teams might have coming in. Bruce Weber did mention it last night that this is the closest thing that K-State has to a bye week during the Big 12 schedule, being a big Monday game and now not playing until Saturday. Meanwhile, West Virginia does play Wednesday night, and it's an 8 o'clock Central, 9 o'clock Eastern time game against Oklahoma. It's going to be a very late night for them getting home, and then they will have one day off before hosting K-State on Saturday. I could see a situation where West Virginia does not get up for that game, and maybe it's very similar to what happened in Waco, where K-State comes out and punches its opponent in the mouth. But that might be asking too much for this team. I don't know. I'm just saying that I could potentially see something like that.
Well, it's a good point. I hadn't studied the Big 12 schedule this week, so I didn't realize that they were playing on the road at OU on Wednesday night. And so that means that West Virginia is probably going to get in back to Morgantown around 4 a.m. Mm-hmm. with the time zone change. And so, you know, that makes Thursday really a day that they probably, you know, might not even practice. And then Friday is probably a shoot-around day. So I think that's certainly a good point. The one thing with West Virginia is that they, you know, they play so many guys that I think they'll certainly have their legs going against K-State. So I'm not sure that'll be a huge issue, but it does certainly affect the prep time going into that game.
Yeah, it's definitely not a situation like Kansas last night, coming off of an overtime game against Iowa State and only being 7 or 8 guys deep as it is. So I certainly see your point on that. Cole, appreciate the time stopping by, and thanks for stopping by yesterday, by the way. That was a good time with you here in studio. We'll talk to you next week.
All right, it was good to see you yesterday. Thanks, Tyler.
All right, that's Cole Manbeck, our PowerCat Game Day blogger. We're going to head to our first break of this second hour. Need to air a correction at the moment. I mentioned coming into the segment that MHS basketball is playing Shawnee Heights tonight. Was totally mistaken there. It is Washburn Rural that they are playing, both the boys and the girls tonight. No idea why Shawnee Heights was on the mind, but it is the Junior Blues for MHS and a couple of competitive games, I would expect, for both the boys and the girls. John Kurtz and Mitch Fortner will have the call starting at the top of the hour. When we come back, one player in particular that has been underperforming a little bit in Big 12 play, and I think him getting on track is absolutely critical for the Wildcats moving forward, plus where they sit right now in the NCAA tournament picture. That's coming up next on The Game.